We have a wonderful speaker tonight, and rather than spend any time giving you a long-winded introduction or anything like that, I will just introduce her and let her introduce herself. Gail D. from Rosslyn, Virginia. Gail, come on up.
I am an alcoholic, and my name is Gail DeWitt. Thank you. I believe you. I love you too. This is a new sensation, I'll tell you. I've never felt nothing like this before. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. Salt Lake City Committee, and thank you, God. Thank you. I'm here because I'm powerless over alcohol, and I can't drink in safety. And I tell you, in the condition that I came in when I first got here, that was music to my ears to find out that the past 10 or 11 years that I had spent in hell was about the fact that I just can't drink in safety. And that, yes, indeed, I was crazy, but there is a solution, you know? And I didn't drink, and I came here, and I found out about the solution. But let me tell you a little bit about what got me here. I think most of you know in a word, what got me here was pain, a great deal of pain. And all the time that I was drinking, I had not a clue that what was wrong with me was alcoholism. Not a clue. How it happened for me is that I started drinking before I was double digits in age, you know? And I've never had a legal drink of alcohol, you know? I started drinking and messed up and hit bottom all before I was 21 years old. I came to AA when I was 20 and felt like I had 90 years of wreckage on my body and in my head. And I was just a mess, just a mess. I came here and I saw you people, and from my very first meeting, I heard the message. And what it sounded like to me, in the sick and frightened and battered spiritual condition that I was in, what I heard was some hope, some hope. I remember that at my first meeting, a woman that I never saw before put her arms around me. So I started crying. I identified in right away. And she put her arm around me and said, Gail, you never have to feel this bad again. You know, there is a solution. What happened to me was, I'm the oldest of five kids, and I come from a family where my dad was an alcoholic. And what happened to me in that family was that I believed that if I was not born alcoholic, that I was preconditioned by my father's disease. And I learned things when I was like this high, I guess that most kids don't think about. The kind of things that I was preoccupied with in an alcoholic home were trying to keep myself safe and trying to keep the other members of my family safe from my father's drinking. And I was a hyper alert little kid. And I learned to read all the signals about when there was going to be trouble in my house. And I didn't spend time thinking about how good life was or really enjoying toys or that kind of thing. I spent a lot of time worrying about the condition my dad was going to be in and what the tone was going to be like in our house, you know, when he came home. And I learned how to read signals real, real well, you know, real well. And kind of what happened is that I believe that I was conditioned to be drunk, and all that was waiting for me was for the wet to get poured on. I believe I've always been an alcoholic. So around the age of 8 or 9, I poured the wet on. And how that happened was, my family history is kind of incredible. The fact that I'm standing here continually amazes me because of the addiction on both sides of my family. I was able to drink at such a young age because most of my, the people who were around me that were older, like my aunts and uncles and that kind of thing, were alcoholic. On my father's side and on my mother's side, there's heavy drug addiction, heavy drug addiction. And where I first picked up my first drink was at my father's older sister's house. And my aunt, God rest her soul, she just died at the beginning of this month, was a fall down, pass out drunk with 6 children, you know? And I would wait, we would wait for my aunt to fall down and pass out in the house, and we would drink what was whatever was left. And that's how I started drinking. I can remember what I think was my first drink, and what I liked about it was that it was sweet. Thank you. It was sherry, and I was like, ooh, yeah, this is it. And I liked the feeling, I liked the warm glow, and that's what I chased all the years that I drank. I chased that warm glow. And the feeling of camaraderie that I felt with my cousins and the other members of my family when I had that drink. I didn't worry about what condition my father was in. I didn't worry about if my mother was going to get hit. I didn't worry about whether or not I was going to get hit. It just made everything okay. And that's the feeling that I kept running after. And as you know, as drinking progressed, it eludes you, you know, it just eludes you. I chased that feeling till I just about died, you know. So kind of what happened in my family was that because of my dad's drinking, my folks split up when I was about 8 or 9 years old. And I'll tell you, I got to tell you about this because it was a real turning point in my life. I was really emotionally shattered from that breakup. It was very confusing for me because the two people that I loved the best and that I looked to for security were a mess. They were a mess. And it was really frightening to me, the conditions we were living in together, but it was very terrifying to me when we split up. I had no idea what was going to happen. And inside it just felt like, hold on to anything, because I thought I was going to just disappear. And you know, we moved out of the house I was used to, and my dad, who I loved dearly, was gone. And he was pulled away out of the house by police, and everybody in town knew about it, and this was not the first time that kind of situation had happened. And I was just shattered. And I'll tell you, the thing that really marks the turning point that kind of happened to me then was that I knew not to talk about it. I knew from the teaching that I got in my family that what went on in our house stayed in our house. And I was smart enough to even know that what went on in my head stayed in my head. You know, we didn't talk about this stuff, you know? And a big turning point for me at that time, besides being shattered, I made the decision that you don't tell anybody about this. You don't say that you feel sick. You're so scared that you're sick inside. You don't make any noise to upset things any further because maybe I'll disappear, you know, like my dad did. Everything was so shaky and so insecure. I mean, I was terrified. And I just said, hold on to yourself. Don't tell anybody a thing. That stayed with me just like chasing the good warm feeling that alcohol gave me stayed with me. Don't tell anybody a thing. So as you can see, You know, when you're walking around in terror and you're real insecure and you don't have anything to hold on to and you decide not to tell, that makes for what I believe is mental illness, serious mental illness. And it's the beginning of, like, you know, your spirit shutting down. You start to close off from the sunlight of the spirit. You just start closing inward. And really, that in a nutshell is what my drinking was about, just kind of sinking into myself and sinking into myself to the point where I felt like I had no connection with other human beings. None. I forgot what made people laugh. I forgot what motivated people to want to have families and want to work. I forgot what joy was. I just didn't feel connected. I started acting out when I was in, like, junior high school, in my addiction. And it looked pretty normal at first, I'm sure. You know, I just started skipping school a little bit, and every now and then, when I had a little whiskey or a little sherry or something in my stomach, I would start to hiss back at my mom about coming from a broken family, and some of the anger started leaking out. And I was trying to keep the lid on that kind of stuff, but it seemed like every time I got my hands on some alcohol, I was just like, let a little bit of it slip out there, you know? And what progression was for me was that instead of it slowly hissing out, the lid got ripped off and it came roaring out. What helped that roar to happen was that I started mixing drugs and alcohol. And now that also was very easy for me to do because, as I mentioned, my mom's family, heavy, heavy smack dealers. You know, as I was growing up and dealing with all this inside crap about feeling insecure and scared and the progression of my own disease, there's been stuff going on around me. Let me tell you a little bit about that. On my mother's side of the family, when I was about 10 years old, a cousin of mine who was and I don't know where he is now, but I think he's still a junkie, was picked up for suspicion of the murder of his wife. They found my cousin's wife stabbed in the chest 24 times, and they picked up my cousin for that murder. And I remember, you know, hearing that on the radio, waking up and listening to my radio and hearing that my cousin friend who had been picked up for that, and it was another turning point. It was like, oh my God, oh my God, I can't keep this secret, you know what I mean? It's like, so that kind of stuff was happening to me, and these people weren't like far away. They're people that I sat with and ate with and I grew up with. When I was like 10 or 11 years old, when my cousin Franny was shooting up, I used to tie him off. And that's the kind of stuff that I was seeing. When I was about 13 years old, his brother, chasing down his addiction, walked broad daylight with a sawed-off shotgun into a drugstore and killed a man, just trying to get what he needed to take care of his habit. And I remember hearing about that, and as I'm hearing about these things, my own disease is progressing, and it was just like more terror and more fear. No one in my family ever said anything about addiction. No one ever said anything about alcoholism. But I was watching the people who I loved and cared for slowly, for violent things, disappear, you know, put behind bars for long periods of time. And my drinking is slowly progressing. What started to happen to me was when I mixed the drugs and the alcohol, I was about somewhere between 13 and 16 years old, and what started happening was I lost all control and pretense of control, and I stopped being able to do things like get to school on a regular basis, and I stopped being able to come home on a regular basis. And I tell you how alcoholism, the progression was for me, is that everybody on the outside always seemed shocked at what I was going through and what was happening to me. But for me, I mean, I was like, what are they so surprised at? I had always felt this way. I never understood what people were so surprised at. It's like, I had been living with it for so long, and I guess kept it down for so long that they were shocked, and I would be like, well, what's the big deal, you know? It didn't surprise me the first time I didn't come home and I didn't tell anybody where I was. And it didn't surprise me when I got kicked out of school, and it didn't surprise me when I got in with a gang of people who started stealing. You know, the progression and the acceptance of crap in your life happens real subtly and real slowly, and it just, the disease just took me along, you know? It just took me along. And I went, you know? I just went. I'm powerless over alcohol. And I swear, with the best of intentions, like I am going to go to school, I am going to try to keep myself clean, I'm going to try to be a member of my family, I'm going to try not to cause these people any grief. Once I got any kind of mood-altering thing in my system, that thing called the shot. The booze called it, the joint called it, the speed called it. Once I was in my system, I had no control over whether or not I was going to do any of those things that I thought that I had wanted to do previously to picking it up. And you know, I didn't catch on to that till I got here and you guys told me that, you know? I mean, I was just being led around, you know, that my disease was just pulling me around. What bottom looked like for me was, I was out on the West Coast, and not only did I leave home, the progression got that I just split. I put on a backpack and I stuck my thumb out, and I just split. I'd gotten kicked out of school and had done some things that had broken my family's heart so badly, I knew I had to leave. And I was in so much pain that their reaching out just caused me more pain because I couldn't meet the grip, you know? When the hands were outstretched, the fact that I couldn't reach out for the help that they wanted to offer caused me so much pain, I went and hung around with people that didn't offer any help. I didn't want to feel the feelings of, or see the looks, or deal with the fact that I was so out of control. So I was with people, other people who were out of control. They didn't reach out their hand. They didn't try to say help. We weren't preoccupied with trying to love each other. We were just getting screwed up, you know? And I didn't have to feel that. I didn't have to feel the pain of looking into like my family's eyes and seeing their confusion, you know? So I got out of there. I got out of there and I stayed with strange people as much as I could, you know? What family meant to me was pain, you know? It meant confusion and it meant hurt. And it meant being more shattered, and I didn't want no more parts of family. And so I hung out with strangers. And all you have to do to always be with strangers is to keep moving, you know? And that's what I did. I just kept moving. Anytime I got someplace and I got a little comfortable, and people started to feel like they knew me a little bit, I would sabotage it. And how I'd sabotage it was, I'd do the same old things that I always did. I would steal, and I'd let them know that I stole. I'd bring stolen goods into their house. I'd bring strange people into their homes. I was just raggedy. I did raggedy things. And people who were decent and trying to be decent to me just couldn't accept the things that I was doing. They were sick. They were nuts. And what happened was the progression got to be that maybe when I first hit the road and stuck my thumb out, I'd go someplace and maybe I could stay like 6 to 8 weeks and everything would be fine for that length of time. And then I would do something like mess around with the wrong man, you know, steal something. And then they'd say, "Gail, you got to go. Sorry, but you have to go." And what the progression was that over a period of time, that time shrank. You know, it was no longer 2 months, it might be 2 weeks. And, you know, it's a different place and different faces and always the same result. You got to go. And I sabotaged and set that up, you know. I didn't want it to feel like family. I thought it was safer to be alone, you know. I just felt safer that way. And I felt safe on the road by myself going to wherever the hell I was going. And where I ended up, just before I came into the program, I ended up on the West Coast with some people that I had met down at Mardi Gras. And, you know, it was pretty wild. My stealing escalated from, like, going into stores and stealing enough food to eat, or stealing music that I wanted to hear, to being with people who stole cars and robbed stores and who were ready to deal death. I mean, you know, breaking into people's homes. I have broken into people's homes while people were in there. And when you're doing stuff like that, you know, you're ready for confrontation. And I was with people and we carried weapons. And that's kind of what I was doing. And I was out on the West Coast with people, and we were all doing the same thing. You know, we were getting high every day, and I got really scared because I was starting to get glimpses of how sick and insane I was, and that I didn't know these people, and that all we were really doing was getting screwed up, and what we were doing to maintain our addiction was getting pretty sick and drastic. And I had a great deal of shame about myself and about my life, and I knew that I was in big trouble. I was with people out in LA County who were a lot slicker and faster than me, and I was like, you know, I felt the impending doom, and the doom said, you know, you could die here. Move. The only thing I knew to do when I got terrified or when things started to feel like they might be like family was to move, you know. And I started getting scared. And I didn't get scared about the drugs I was doing. I didn't get scared about the stealing or the outside stuff. What was really scary to me was what was happening in my gut, what was happening in my head, and the fact that there seemed to be no control. And then I was sinking into a black hole, and I didn't feel any way to get out of there. And definitely what I was doing wasn't helping me get out. And every now and then I'd get glimpses of that I was sinking, and I didn't know why or what to do about it. And it was just terrifying. That fear dragged me back across the coast, back to Newport, Rhode Island, where I was born and raised. And when I got back there, some other things had gone down in my family. You know, this disease has wiped out a whole lot of my family, a whole lot. And when I got back home, a 15-year-old member of my family had the back of his head blown off, chasing down his addiction. And another relative, 18 years old, down on what we call the block in Newport, had bullets pumped into his stomach in a street fight, dead, you know, and it was just scary. It's just scary. And the only way I knew to hang on to myself was to keep being screwed up. You know what? I had the illusion that I could make myself feel better if I changed the outside things. And when I left the West Coast, I was so terrified about where I was and the kind of things that was going on. I made a little promise to myself. I said, you know, if you go home and you stop dressing like a hippie and you get legal, don't do any more drugs, stop stealing, try to look like straight people do, you know, put on nice clothes, get an apartment, and just drink, you'll be okay. Why don't you try that, and I think you'll probably be okay. So that's what I did. I went back to Rhode Island, and as I was watching other people, you know, around me get popped off, by the disease, I was setting up this scenario to look good. You know, I got a nice apartment and threw away my hippie clothes and tried to get the background to look real good. And controller that I am, I mean, it didn't take me real long to do that. And the thing that was very baffling to me was that I had set that up, did that, and was sitting in this apartment with this little goody-two-shoes nurse, a woman that was going to nursing school, and I felt sicker than I ever did. And I was drinking every single day, and I swear to God, I had not a clue that what was happening inside of me and why I felt so badly had to do with drinking. And people were starting to confront me about that a little bit, and I just couldn't hear it. I shut it down. The way I shut people down was I really practiced on being a cut mouth. Because of the insight that I learned as a kid to watch the symptoms of my father's disease, I had a great deal of insight into people and what their pressure points, what their buttons were. And if anybody approached me about my drinking or my lifestyle, I went for that little button, that pressure point, and I would talk so hard and so fast and mostly so filthy that they would leave. And they'd leave me alone, and they wouldn't address the subject again. And the last couple of people who tried to talk to me about my drinking, that's what I did. I did to them what I did to my mom and my brothers and my sisters. I sliced them up with my mouth, and they left. They left. And when everybody left, is how I hit bottom. I absolutely hate, and I remember this like yesterday. When my roommate left, and it was just me with me all the time, I hated it. I hated it. And I still was able to work at that time, but it was real uncomfortable for me because I lied a lot. And my lies was causing a lot of people grief. And because the only other human interaction I had was at work, I lied on those people, and they weren't real friendly to me. Because I was so sick and so unhappy, and so much into self-hate, I told lies that they could find out about. And of course, it was not a good situation. So, you know, what bottom was for me was that I had severed all healthy, good, any kind of loving human connection. I severed that and told myself, you know, that it was okay to be 19, 20 years old and to be isolated and sick and tired and not to have any kind of connection with people. It was okay if they didn't want to talk to me. You can just leave me alone. You know, don't touch me. Just leave me the hell alone. I don't want you to touch me anyway. Touching is about pain. I don't want no more pain, you know? I didn't realize that every time I picked up a glass that I was causing myself pain. What happened to me, left alone, sitting there day after day with myself, living in this little tiny space in my head, was what the bottom was like. And it was about night sweats and hallucinating with my eyes wide open and desperate, just a desperate, sick, hurt puppy. And I had not a clue about what to do about that. You know, God's grace is an incredible thing. An incredible thing. I'm steeped in this kind of misery, and my world was very small. What I did was I worked right across the street from where I lived so that I didn't have to be seen. You know, I would cringe from people looking at me. People looking at me, I was so raw from this disease that when you looked at me, it made me physically feel pain. I mean, it made my skin hurt. So what I did was, so I didn't have to be exposed to your looks, was that I made my world very tiny, and I worked right across the street from where I lived, and there was a liquor store on the corner, And it was a real tiny space to live. And I didn't do eye contact with people when I had to see you. And I just felt sick and ashamed. And I'd get my booze and I'd go to work. And I got on their nerves. And I'd come home and I'd be terrified. And I'd sit there and I'd be on the couch or on my bed. And I would drink until I passed out. And passing out didn't happen for me all the time. And it didn't always happen fast enough. And I would think about, I had a phobia about dark spaces, and I'd look at the doorway, and I'd dream up a scary, I mean, you know, I was another Stephen King, the stuff that I could think up. And I would scare myself to death, you know? And I was real aware that other people who were my age were going to the beach and talking about going to college, and loved the sunshine and were sailing and enjoying, you know, the beautiful place that Newport, Rhode Island is. And I was holed up with the shades down, no telephone, getting drunk. And lucky for me, there were people in the hospital who worked there who were in AA who saw me coming in and out of that little space day after day in my misery and knocked on my door. And the person that knocked on my door was an 18-year-old girl who had a year of sobriety. And what happened was she knew that I worked at the hospital. They'd seen me around. They'd been watching me. And they told me this later on. And she said to me, she asked if I wanted to go out for coffee. And I didn't want to because I didn't want her to look at me because it made me feel so queasy and sick. But I was so sick and I was so tired. There was a little part of me that just wanted some human contact. And I know you know what that conflict is like, to want to get out of hell so bad, but just too sick to help yourself out, you know? And that's kind of the space that I was in. So when she asked me if I wanted to go out for coffee, I said, yeah. And she said, meet me in this room upstairs in the hospital when you have a break and we'll talk. And that's how I got to my first AA meeting. I went in this room to meet this girl, and I opened the door, and there were about 20 people sitting around a table. And yeah. And I stood in the doorway, and somebody kicked the chair out from the table and said, sit down, you know? And I sat down, and let me tell you guys, as sick and tired as I was, my condition heard you. And I sat down there, and people were sharing about, out loud, about the things that I was so ashamed of, that I was going to go to the grave with, and I just started to sob. And what was sobbing in me was this big piece of ice, you know, that started to break loose a little bit, and I heard, now I didn't know this in words, but I had the feeling that I was someplace safe and where there might be a solution. That was the feeling. There was something in me, the feeling I ran away from, there was something in that meeting that felt kind of like home, and it terrified me, and at the same time, there was just enough grace, or whatever it was, the will to live in me, that I heard you guys saying that you are alcoholic, and I identified. I identified myself in, not by what you said that you did, you know, but when you said how you felt about what you did, when you talked about the shame and the self-pity and the anger and the rage and the hypersensitiveness, and I said, oh my God, oh my God, that's me, you know? And it felt like home. It still feels like home. I love it here. So that's how my sobriety started. I've been really fortunate. Real sick cookie I brought in here, and that was my first meeting, and I've been sober a day at a time since then. Yeah. And I tell you, the reason why I'm sober, or how I stayed sober at that time, was the real basic things that we do today. I did not drink, and I went to meetings. Same thing I'm doing now, almost 15 years later. I don't drink, and I go to meetings. Yeah. When I first came around, that's about all I did right. I didn't drink, and I came to meetings, and I let that little bit of ice that was melting and breaking, you guys gave me enough of what I needed to come and not be afraid of that meltdown. It's very, very scary when you've turned yourself into a block of steel to feel the heat coming, to feel love coming at you, you know? And I was scared shit. So I moved. When I was 6 weeks sober, I left the country and I went to London for a month, and I spent the next 7 months in Paris, France. And I did there what you showed me my first 6 weeks in the States. I didn't drink and I went to meetings. And I stayed sober. And that's about all I did right. All the unwritten suggestions, like don't get involved. I was in Paris for 2 weeks. I got hooked up with a man because I liked his English accent. And the both of us together had 3 months of sobriety. And I moved right in with him. I thought I was in heaven, you know? And a woman who was 10 years sober that lived in Paris started knocking gently on my door at meetings, and she was saying things to me like, you know, Gail, us women in AA stand on our own 2 feet, you know? Get out of there. And I didn't want to listen to her, and this woman was bold. She was really bold. You know, you get sobriety, you start feeling good, you get bold with people. And she would get in my face. You know, I'd be like, she'd say, I want you to move out of there. And I'd be like, well, no, it's none of your business. And so what she did was she got us out for coffee in front of a bunch of other people, and she embarrassed the hell out of us, and I got out of there. And what happened was, when I was away from that distraction and living by myself, people helped me get busy. And this woman had me going to meetings, and I was in French classes, and I was in pottery classes, and I was going to the Alliance to learn French, and the pain started coming, sober pain. The only thing I was doing was not drinking and going to meetings, and I was crawling inside my own skin. And I started talking to her about that, and she said, if you want some relief from that, if you want to feel okay in your own skin sober, Gail, you're going to have to work the steps. And, yeah. And I tell you, the only reason why I started to even look at the big book in the 12 and 12 was because I got to a point in my early sobriety where I was so unhappy with myself and so uncomfortable that I knew I was going to leave if I didn't get some kind of relief. And you guys kept telling me that the relief was in the steps. And I believed you. You know, the part of me that was melting and coming alive believed you. And what I absolutely love about you guys is that as sick as I can be, you know, on any given day, when you tell me the truth, it gets past my bullshit right in here, and I hear you. I hear you. And no one's ever done that for me before. You know, my mom's voice and her pain didn't do it. Clergy people didn't do it. Doctors didn't do it. When you guys tell me the truth about my condition, no matter what's going on in my head, I don't care if I want to deny, I hear you, you know? And I heard that I needed to work the steps, and my pain drove me to my knees, and I started looking at that. When I was about 7 or 8 months sober, I came back to the States because I was told that it was really important for me to learn to be sober on the ground that I had gotten drunk on. And I came home, and I was scared shit, because that was about family again. About looking my folks in the face, and dealing with my feelings, and I thought those feelings would kill me. You know, I thought the disease said, Gail, if you dare try to deal with this stuff sober, I'll kill you. You know, I'll kill you. And you guys said, the disease is lying. Yet the very opposite is true. If you try to deal with this under the umbrella of the 12 steps, you'll live like you never lived before. And yeah. And against this much hate and self-pity and fear that I had for myself, you guys were helping me work with just this little bit of self-esteem that I had from making coffee and putting out chairs and selling raffle tickets, you know, and giving other newcomers a big book. And doing that kind of stuff helped the self-esteem to grow enough that I started to want good things for myself, and I started to want to work the steps, and I got busy. Thank goodness for the sober women in this program. I love you. I love you. Yeah. Because they got a hold of me, and how I was when I first came in the program was that, you know, when you're as frightened as I was, and you want to keep people away the way I did, you bark very loud, you know? And I was like, bitchy and vulgar and real brash. And there were some women who were sober for a while who dealt with that. And they saw my 6-foot angry frame come, and they didn't back up. They stood the ground and said, time to work the 4th step, you know? Now tell me what you wrote. And as I was going through that process for the first time, and cried about the things that I had done way before I picked up a drink, and cried for the members of my family that were dying and were going to jail, and trying to deal with my survival guilt. I had so much guilt for surviving, you know, for trying to survive this thing. People helped me deal with that with the steps, and I started to get stronger, and I started to get sober. Not dry, I started to feel what sobriety was like. And what it began feeling like was caring. I cared if the meeting had coffee and if the chairs were set up, and I cared that the newcomer was told, keep coming back. And I cared that my 4th step was thorough. And I cared that the person I picked to tell my 5th step to, that I used prudent to pick that person. I cared that I was going to kneel before God as I understand him and ask him to help me be willing to have my defects removed. I started to care so much that I started to come alive, you know? The steel was coming down, the ice was melting, and I started to love you and to care. And you loved me so much, and you cared so much, you just wore my resistance down. That's what happened. You wore me down, man. I practiced the same things that I practiced when I was drinking for a while in sobriety. And one of the things that I did was I hitched around still. And I went to my first Icky Par in Memphis, Tennessee in 1975. I was a year sober, and I hitched down there, and what I saw was incredible. It was just incredible. Here we were, a lot of you just like me, off the street, celebrating and holding on to each other and telling our worst secrets and loving each other and celebrating being sober and drug-free, you know? And the spirit of that Ikipa and what it did for me, what you're still doing for me, has made me just want to live. I think the best thing and the most wonderful thing that I can do in my life is to carry the message to another alcoholic and to let them know there is a solution. You don't have to die with this thing, you know? We don't have to get rubbed out by this thing. Yeah, that was my first Icky Paw was a trip. I hitched to Denver too for AA's 40th birthday. And at that time I was like 11 months sober, and I saw all those people there, I almost went crazy. I mean, I couldn't believe, I knew AA was bigger than Newport, Rhode Island. I knew it was bigger than Paris, France. I had no idea it was like this, you know? And what happened to me, what you guys did for me when I saw us all like this, together and clean and sober and celebrating and smiling and spending our money and our time to be together, I promised myself, a real turning point for me, I promised myself that no matter what condition I was in, that I would not drink and come to meetings a day at a time so I could be near this thing. I know that my salvation, the only salvation for me, is here. I don't mess around with it. I don't trust my sobriety in the hands of anything else. I bring it here to you, you know? And I've never been disappointed with what I've gotten back. Every time you point me to a step and I try to work it, I get relief from my pain and from my anger and from the self-hatred and from the self-pity. And not only did I get relief from that, there's been joy, you know? As I started to deal with the wreckage of my past, I got lighter feeling, and my spirit started to heal, and I stopped thinking about my past, and I started to see today, and I wanted to stop being a bum, and I wanted to get educated, you know, and people helped me fill out the paperwork, and I went to college, and yeah. And you walked me into getting my first job. And you were with me when I got that first raise. And you were with me as I've lost members of my family. Let me tell you what the month of May has been like for me. You know, when I first picked up a drink at my aunt's house, she died at the beginning of the month, a week before her 62nd birthday, in the same condition that she had been in, as far as I can remember, drunk, you know? And this lady, just like me and you, absolutely wonderful person, just totally robbed of her life because of her alcoholism. And she died, and I grieved. And as we were grieving about that, and I was dealing with, alcoholism has taken another one away. Some really sad things happened. They buried my aunt on May 3rd, and it was like a week before her 62nd birthday, and her oldest daughter, who had disappeared, she was kind of like I was. She disappeared like 15 or 20 years ago. She's about 5 years older than me. Came back to Rhode Island about a year ago and was hanging around. She came back, obviously, on the skids, a real sick puppy. And when her mother died, my poor cousin, she was so wasted, she didn't go to the funeral. She didn't make it. And they tried to get her up out of bed, and she was just too wasted. She couldn't do it. And so they buried her mom, and they called and told me that my cousin Esther didn't make the funeral. And I said to my mom, and she told me that, I said, Mom, somebody hold on to her, because when she comes to out of that crack and realizes that she did that, she's going to be a hurting puppy. Hang on to her. I was scared for her. And what happened was, see, this disease, we're powerless over it. You can't hang on. You can't hang on. What happened was, when my cousin Esther did get on her feet, what she did was, on her mother's birthday, which was a week later, she went to her gravesite and she committed suicide by ODing herself. And when they called and told me that, I was so fucking angry. It's like, yep, the disease got another one, you know, 2 in a week. And I was so frightened and so scared. I was walking around my apartment and I was just kind of hanging on to myself. And I was like, good God, how am I sober? How did I make it here? You know, we're shooting each other and we're committing suicide. How am I in Alcoholics Anonymous with all this stuff going on around me? The other thing that happened in the month of May, a lot of you know that I have a brother 2 years younger than myself that's been doing life in prison because of his addiction. And about 2 years ago, they let him out after serving about 10 years. And my brother is very much like me. We drank together and we drugged together. I know what he's about. And I wish that he was here to see what we have. But his addiction, after being out on the street for 6 months, drove him to attempt to take the lives of 2 other people. And they put him back in jail. And this month he wrote us a confession, like a 20-page confession, and telling us about what it had been like to be in jail all that time and what it was like to commit that kind of crime. And I hurt, and I said, God, how am I sober? This is where I'm coming from. The disease is wiping out my family. It's got my brothers behind bars, probably for the rest of his life. And I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous for almost 15 years. How does that happen? And I tell you, the good news about hearing and seeing that kind of thing and being sober is that being a member of my family, I was able to be part of the solution and to help my mom deal with what she had to read in that letter. And we just hung on to each other. And we just loved each other. And I was just being there. We were just being there for each other. And it just felt good for me to say to my mom, this is how I feel about it. But Ma, I have no idea what it's like to be a mother and to read what you had to read in that letter. And I don't know what it's like to be a mother and for you to see what I've been through. Tell me about that. Tell me about your pain. And she did. And I felt really good to be a sober member of AA and to be able to be strong enough and to be with her and to hear what her pain was like and to get through with it, you know, to get through with it. And I love you for helping me be part of the solution in my family, because this disease is fucking wiping us out. If there's anything that I would say to a newcomer is that if you're lucky enough to be in this room tonight, you've paid your dues. You've paid your dues. Hang on to your seat. Because if you want to pick up a drink or a drug, and you're the kind of drunk that I am, alcoholism will take you. You know, the yets are out there. They're out there. It's no joke. You'll go to jail, and they'll lock you up. Or you'll commit suicide, or you'll get the back of your head blown off, you know, or you'll get shot in the stomach, you know. It's waiting for us, you know. And I thank God for the grace and the mercy that let me hear that I am an alcoholic and I am powerless over alcohol, and that together we have a solution. I love that message, and I'm the proud bearer. I want to tell you that this thing works. And if I thought that any place else had more to offer, I'd be there. I'd be there. I wouldn't be here, you know? I love you guys. I thank you for my life. Thank you for my sobriety. I've gone from a street corner mess up to my life feeling, you know, the healing has been from the inside out. As the hate and the self-pity and the anger has melted away, it's been replaced by your love and your care and mine. My getting that message from you and wanting to carry that on has been everything. And my life feels sunny and good. And I am clean and sober because of you guys. I'm clean and sober. And I love it. I love it. I just want to once again thank Salt Lake City Committee for asking me to be here. I love you guys. All my heart, I love you. And let's keep carrying the message.